And Yod Amud Aleph, second line. We left off. Yesterday we talked about how Rish Lakish blamed the Jews of Bavel, that they didn't all come to build after the Golas Bavel to rebuild the second Beis HaMikdash, and because of that it meant that the Shechinah, he said that because of that the Shechinah didn't rest in the second Beis HaMikdash to the extent that it did in the first one, and that in turn created all kinds of problems that existed throughout the time of the second Beis HaMikdash. So Rish Lakish blamed the Jews of Bavel for that. If they had all come together kachoyma, like a wall, then it would have been the Gula Amid Tisvashleim. So then we said that Rabbi Yochanan told Rish Lakish actually not so. It has nothing to do with that. It's rather, the reason is because the second Beis HaMikdash was built under the direction and under the permission of the kings of Persia who descended from Yefes. As the, since the pasuk says, Yafta, the king of Yefes, Hashem will expand Yefes, the Yishkan, Ba'alei Shem, but he will dwell in the tents of shame, means that even, that the Shechina will only be in its fullest measure, only in a Beis HaMikdash that's built by the descendants of shame, which Shlomo HaMelech was and Kodesh was not. So now let's figure out, the Gemara says, Ufarsoi Menolan to be Yefes Kasu. How do we know that the Persians descend from Yefes? Now, broadly speaking, Mephoshim explained that the three sons of Noach, Shem, Ham, and Yefes, broadly speaking, Shem is the ancestor of many of the nations of Asia. We talk nowadays even about the Semitic nations, the Semitic meaning that come from Shem. Yefes, broadly speaking, of the European peoples, and Chom of the African ones. But as we're going to see in the Gemara, at least the way according to our Gemara says it, there's a lot of overlap. There's a lot of descendants of Yefes that live in various parts of Asia. And maybe even Africa. The identities that the Gemara is going to mention over here about a number of these nations, this isn't the only source about it. There's other places where Chazal themselves talk about it. For example, you have there's a Yerushalmi, there's in Medrash Rabbah on these Psukim, in Perek Yod Bereshis, and then you have all the different Mefarshim on the Psukim. Many of them have different understandings of where these nations are, but here we have in the Gemara over here one set of definitions. So the pasuk says Bnei Yefes Gomer Umagog Umadai VeYavon VeSuvol UMeshach VeSiras. So let's identify what are the names of the places where each of the names of the nations that each of them founded. Number one, Gomer is the Germania. Gomer refers to what was known in the times of the Gemara as Germania. Now Hagoyes Hagro changes that to Germania, which may well be Germany. There are different other explanations. Even according to the Gersa Germania, and certainly according to Germania that we have over here, that it may be some area in what's nowadays Iran, or some area in what's nowadays the Ukraine. There was a nation that's known from historical records in those days called the Cimmerians or Cimmerians, so that could be Germania. They lived approximately in what's nowadays Ukraine. Next, Magog Zukandia. Magog refers to Candia, which is the name of the capital of Crete. Crete is an island in the Mediterranean. Nowadays it's part of Greece. Different Gersa over here again that a number of the Rishonim have, that the for example, Rabbi Hananel says over here Ginsa. Different other Rishonim have a Gersa Gumsa or whatever, not instead of Candia, which in that case it refers to the area where the Goths lived, which is broadly speaking in Eastern Europe, also in parts of Ukraine and Romania and whatever. Modai zu Macedonia. Modai, the Gersa we have in front of us, is that Modai means Macedonia, which is north of Greece. Nowadays half of it is in Greece, and half of it is in what used to be Yugoslavia. Yavan Kamashmo. Yavan then would mean exactly what it sounds like, Greece. A different Gersa over here, Agos Abach, changes it. To Modai is Kmashmoi. Modai means what it sounds like, is like we have like Poras and Modai that are mentioned in many places in Tanakh, meaning in English it's called media, nowadays it's part of Iran. And Yavon would be and Yavon then would be Macedonia, which would be Macedonia, which is where Alexander the Great and his family came from. That's where the name Alexander Moichdon means, from Macedonia. Anyway, Tuval is a base on Yaki. The next one in the pasuk, the fifth son of Yefes, is Tuval. That's base on Yaki. In general history, the place is called Bithynia. It's nowadays in northern Turkey, just south of the Black Sea. Meshech, we're bringing this whole list in order to show that the Persians, eventually we're going to have on this list, the Persians that are descended from Yechez. The sixth one is Meshech Zumusia. Meshech refers to a place called Musia, which is also in Turkey nowadays, in western Turkey. Tiras, and now the seventh son, Tiras, Pligibarab Simoi Virabonan. Reb Simoi and the Rabbanan disagree what Tiras means in the Pasuk. Some say it was Reb Simoi and the Chachamim, Va'amilor Reb Simon v'Rabbanan. Others say it was Reb Simon arguing with the Chachamim. Anyway, Chad Amazu Beis Triyaki. One says that Tiras is Beis Triyaki, which in later times is called Thrace. It's an area now in the corner of Europe. It's split between part of it is in Turkey, part of it is in Bulgaria, part of it is in Greece. So that's one opinion. V'chad oma zuparas. The other one says that Tiras is Persia. And Tani Rabbi Yosef, Tiras zuparas. Rabbi Yosef also taught a braisa that Tiras in this pasuk is the ancestor of the Persians. So therefore, you see from that, the Persians come from Yefes, which is what we were out to prove over here, that since the Persians descend from Yefes, therefore the Shechina couldn't fully rest in the Beis Mikdash that was built under the patronage and under the permission of the kings of Persia. Next, since we're talking about the names, since we're talking about the identity of some of the nations over there, so again, in the Yerushalmi and the Medrash and whatever, you have many more explanations of where the different 70 descendants of Noach, where they settled and what the names of their countries are. Here, the Gemara goes through just a couple of them. Among the descendants of Chum, a few psukim later, it says that the sons of Cush, And it lists he also has a bunch of sons, Svav, Chavila, etc. And among them are Savta, Verama, Vesavtacha. So Savta and Savtacha being very similar names, the Gemara assumes that they're talking about two nations that lived in very close proximity to each other. Tony Rabbi Yosef, Sakistan Gavaisa, Vesakistan Baraisa. This refers to Savta and Savtacha are inner Sakistan and outer Sakistan. There was a nation in those days called the Scythians, or Scythians, or Scythians, or whatever. They lived all over the place in Eastern Europe and in Central Asia, in parts of what's now Ukraine and Southern Russia and Kazakhstan and Iran and so on and so forth. And there was a particular area where some of them lived within the Persian Empire. They say that it's nowadays on the border, more or less on the border of Iran and Afghanistan, that was called the land of the Saka. The land of the Scythians, and therefore it's called Sakistan. So the Pashtos, that's the area the Gemara is referring to over here. Bein Chod L'Chod Meir Parsi, the space between one and the other is 100 Parsi. In other words, you have the outer Sakistan is like a ring around the inner one. It's 100 Parsi distance, the border of the inner one from the outer one. So the outer one, in other words, is a ring 100 parsa wide. They have kefa, alpha parsi, and the circumference of the whole area, if the border around it, it's not a perfect circle, obviously, but the border around it is 1,000 parsa. Next. A few psukim later, the pasuk describes how Nimrod went the places where Nimrod ruled over, where he started building his empire. The first places that he ruled over are Bavel, Erech, Akkad, and Kalnei. So the Gemara also identifies those. Bavel Kmashma. Bavel means the famous old city of Bavel. After the time of Belshazzar, it was completely destroyed, and now the whole thing is just ruins. We don't mean the country of Bavel, by the way. There was a city of Bavel within the country of Bavel, just like you have New York City and New York State. So Bavel means the area known in later times also as the city of Bavel. Erech ze Urichus. Erech refers to a place that in the Gemara's times was called Urichus. Nowadays it's called Uruk or something like that. It's a famous old they've done famous archaeological excavations over there. But Akkad ze Bashkar. Akkad refers to a place called Bashkar, or different gears of Kashkar. Kalna is a Neufer Ninfi. Kalna is what was known in the times of the Gemara, as Neufer Ninfi. All of those are very ancient cities in old time Bavel, modern, present day Iraq, and all of them, they've done a lot of archaeological diggings and found all kinds of interesting information over there about the kings and emperors of old Bavel. Then the next pasuk continues. Mina oratzai he yotza Asher. From that land, he went out Asher. Now Rashi on the pasuk explains that what it means is that Asher, who was one of the sons of Shem, left that area when he saw what Nimrod was plotting with the tower of Babel. He left that area rather than be a party to their schemes against Eivishter, and therefore Hashem rewarded him that he was able to build the big cities, the great cities that continues, that the Gemara is going to continue now quoting from the pasuk. The Gemara over here apparently understands rather that the word Asher is the name of a place. Some of them are Farshim on the pasuk. In fact, say that Mina Oretzai he Yotza Asher means from that land in the south of what's now Iraq, he, Nimrod, went out towards Asher, which is now the northern part of Iraq, and built these cities over there. So, Atana Rabbi Yosef, Asher is a Silik. Rabbi Yosef learns that Asher is Silik, is a country, not a country, a city that in Babel, a city in Babel that in later times was called Seleukia. You have the Greek dynasty that ruled over Eretz Yisrael in the years before the Nes Hanukkah were called the Seleucids, the Seleukids or whatever, because their ancestor was named Seleucus. The Pashtus, the Silik, this place Silik was named after him. So in the times of Tanakh it was called Asher. There is an interesting girsa that some of the Rishonim have. Rabbeinu Yochim and Tosfos Rid have a girsa that Asher zen Noyach. That Asher in this pasuk refers to Noyach. Noyach lived for 10 years after the Dor HaFlog, after the Tower of Babel. And according to that, during these 10 years, he built the remainder of his life. He built these four cities that we're going to describe. The pasuk continues by Yivanes Nineveh. He built Nineveh, the famous city of Nineveh from Yonah. It was the capital of Asher in later times. Ves Rechoves Ir Ves Kolach. So Nineveh Kemashmoy. Nineveh means what was known in later times as Nineveh as well. Again, nowadays it's in ruins. And again, they found a lot of interesting stuff there archaeologically. Rechoves Ir Zupros to Mishon. Rechoves Ir refers to the pros in the area of Mishon, which is in southern Iraq. So apparently the Gemara, so even though on the simple meaning of the pasuk, we're saying that all these cities were in one area, all of them in Asher, in northern Iraq, the Gemara apparently is understanding that some of them are all over the place in Iraq. Kolach Zupros to Bursif. Kolach refers to Pros by the city of Bursif, which is a city somewhat south of Babel in Iraq. The Gemara mentions in some places that the people there were not Talmid Chachamim, they were Amoratim. Later, the next pasuk continues. Vas Resen ben Nineveh ben Kolach. Then he built Resen between Nineveh and Kolach. Ki ho Irak Doila. That is the great city. So what is Resen? Zak Tisfon. Resen refers to the city that in later times was called Aktisfon, which was near Mechuza in the center of Babel. Tosfos Yeshanim actually though says again we're saying over here. On the face of it, that these cities are mostly in northern Asher, in northern Iraq. So what's Aktisfon doing over there? So he says maybe there are two different places called Aktisfon. Or maybe what it is that Asher built these places as outposts outside of his actual area, that he built them as outposts, as places for ships or whatever. Okay. Next, the pasuk continues. He ho Irak Dola. The pasuk says it is the great city. So which one of the cities that are mentioned in this pasuk is the great city? The pasuk is saying Resen between Nineveh and between Kolach. So which one of those three, Resen, Nineveh, or Kolach, is the big city? Eidi Agei Nineveh ho Irak Dola im Resen ho Irak Dola. If you just had this pasuk in Parshas Noach, you wouldn't know whether Nineveh or Resen is considered the great city. Later on, you have in the story of Yonah, Nineveh was a great city in Hashem's sight. It took 3 days to walk around it or through it or whatever. Then you have to say that the pasuk is telling us that Nineveh is the big city. Tosfos asks, why don't we ask also, it could be that Kolach is the big city. It's the last one mentioned in the pasuk. So Tosfos says, if the pasuk was telling us that Kolach is the biggest city out of all of them, then it wouldn't have to say he Ho'irak Dola. It would just say Ho'irak Dola, and we'd understand. It just finished saying Kolach. Therefore, we would say Kolach is the Irak Dola. The fact that it says he means that it must be referring back to something earlier in the pasuk, either Resen or Nineveh. And the answer is, again, that since Nineveh is elsewhere called Irak Dola Lelekim, then it means that that's the one that here the pasuk is referring to as the big city. Okay, there are explanations. In fact, one of the Mefoshim on the Pasuk, I think Chizkuni, says that what it was is all these three cities eventually merged together and became one big, gigantic metropolis that was called Nineveh after the main city. So in that sense, all of them, Resen and Nineveh and Kolach, all became one big city. Okay. Next. Since we're darshaning names of places, so the Gemara also digresses to darshan the names of the giants from the time of the Meraglim and of Kolev. The pasuk says Veshamach Chimon Sheshne V'Talmai Yilidei Hanok. There in Chevron, when the Meraglim were in that area, we know that Kolev left them and went into Chevron to daven by the Maris and Machpelah. The rest of them didn't, but in that area, they were all in that area. And the pasuk says that there were Achimon, Sheshe, and Talmai, the children of the giant. So Tana, we learn in Hebrew. So why would they name that? Achimon means Miyumon Shabachim. The first one was called Achimon because he was the strongest of the brothers. Miyumon means literally like the right hand. The right hand is stronger than the left hand. Therefore, Miyumon means the strongest one of the brothers. So Achimon, we darshan as Achyomon, the strongest brother. Sheshai, he's called that Shemesim as the Eretz Kishchisus. Sheshai is called that because he made the whole earth was like pits and like a destroyed area when he walked over there because he was so big and tall that he sank deeply and his feet would sink deeply into the ground. So over here, Rashi explains how does Sheshai become Shchisus because you have the Shurdish of the word is only the one shin. The Gemara also brings this list in Soita with the same Jerusha. There Rashi explains a little differently that the word Sheshai is related to the word Shayish, marble. If you take a marble pillar and put it on the ground, it'll sink deeply into the ground because it's so heavy. So the same way, like his feet were like marble pillars, and they would sink into the ground whenever he walked. And Talmai is called that Shemesim Asar, Tlomim Tlomim, because wherever he went, he made the ground into furrows, again, with the idea being he's so big and heavy that every place where he stepped, it was deeply indented, as if a farmer had come and plowed it with a plow. The Gemara continues, Dover Acher, another explanation, and actually Rashi and Agoris Habach and Agoris Agra all take out the word Dover Acher, because it doesn't really belong. The Gemara is not really giving a different, on the surface, the Gemara is not really giving a different explanation of their names. It's rather saying something that they accomplished. Achimon Bona Anos, Achimon built a place called Anos, Sheshai Bona Olush, Talmai Bona Talbush. So they all built these places. Ben Yehoyada says maybe we could keep the Girsa Dover Acher, the Gemara is mentioning another point, that each one of them built a city and named it in a certain way after himself. The same way as we're saying, for example, Achimon's name is called that because Miyuman Shabachim, it represents the fact that he was the strongest. He also memorialized that in the name of the city that he built, Anos, where he has one letter of his name, the Nun, and so forth with each of the other one. Like one has the letter that represents his name in the middle, another one at the end, Sheshai with Olush at the end, and Talmai with Talbush, with the same letter being at the beginning. So according to that, maybe it is Gavacher. And Yilidei HaAnok, when it says they were the descendants of the Anok, of the giant, means they're called that Shema Nik and Achama B'Kemosan. They make the sun like a necklace around their neck because they're so tall. In other words, they're so tall. When you look at them, it looks like their heads are piercing from your vantage point down below. It looks like their heads are piercing through the sky, and as if like the sun is around their neck like a piece of jewelry. So therefore, they're called Anok because the word Anok means a necklace. Gvuras Ari says it's a bit of a doichet to this explanation of Rashi that because we were darshaning the names, therefore we mentioned these brothers. I mean, we didn't really darshan the names, we just explained where they are, the different places that it mentioned in Parshas Noach. So rather, Gvuras Ari explains that we mentioned how Ashur or Noach or Nimrod or whoever it was built these various cities, Nineveh, Rehoboth, Ir, and so forth. So therefore, the Gemara mentions also these giants, Achimon, Sheshai, and Talmai, who built these cities. There are, in fact, some people, and then the Sansino Gemara, they mention, for example, that these three cities that we're talking about over here, Anos, Olush, and Talbush, may be cities. There are certain islands in northern Iraq that have or had cities on them. Those might be these three, and in that case it would actually be directly connected because having mentioned some cities in Iraq that were built in the times of Noach or a little bit afterwards, so therefore we're mentioning these giants also built more cities in that area. Okay. Going back to we talked before we got into this whole discussion by talking about that Persia, that the Persians are descended from Yefes. So now more on that topic about the Persians. Amar Rebbe Shoban Levi, Amar Rebbe, Asidah Roimi Shitipo B'yad Paras. In the future, the Romans are going to fall into the hands of the Persians. The Romans are going to be defeated by the Persians. Shenema, as the Pasuk says, Lochen Shimu Atzas Hashem Asher Yoatz El Edom. Is that really how the Pasuk says it? Not Allah, like it says in the Gemara over here. Now listen to the advice, to the idea of Hashem, which he has advised regarding Edom. Umachshavos of Asher Choshav El Yosh VeSeimon, and his thoughts, which he's planning against the descendants of Teman. Teman over here doesn't mean Yemen. It means that Teman is one of the descendants of Esav. It's mentioned in the Psukim in Parashas Vayishlach, and in later times it was the name of an area of Eretz Edom. Im lo yischonav, and we know throughout Shas that the Romans are identified with Edom. How that is exactly is a whole other question. One thing is, it's brought in some places that there was a descendant of Esav, one of the ones mentioned in Parashas Vayishlach, named Tzvi, who eventually made his way to Italy and founded a kingdom over there. So in fact, Yesh Omerim, that the Italians by and large are descended from Yefes, but the Romans, especially the Roman elite, are descended from Esav, and therefore it's called Edom. Anyway, the pasuk continues, Im lo yischovum tzeir yatzayin, that it will surely be, imloy is like an expression of a shvua, such and such should happen if this doesn't happen. And of course, with Hashem, he's going to make it happen, therefore it's a loshon of shvua that it will definitely happen. Yischovum tzeir yatzayin, the youngest of the sheep, of the flock, will drag them away, imloy yashim aleim neveim, for sure he will make their houses desolate around them. So the point is, as the Gemara is going to explain soon, Seir Yatzayin over here refers to Persia. So therefore, that means, says Rabbi Yisroel ben Levi, in the name of Rebbe, that it means the Persians eventually are going to defeat the Romans. So the Gemara says, Maskif l'Rabba Ba'ola. So Rabba Ba'ola asks, how are you getting from the word Seir Yatzayin, how are you getting specifically that it means Persia? My mashma dahai tzir atzayin parasu. L'chora, where are you getting that paras can be called the youngest of the flock? With flock as a general term meaning sheep and goats, but pashtus because dichtiv ha'ayel asher isa balak kranayim malchei modei paras. Hashem, the Malach says to Daniel, when Daniel had his vision of the various animals that represent the four kingdoms that are going to rule over the Jewish people from his times until Moshiach's times, Bavel, Paras, the Madai, the Greeks, and the Romans. So he says, Ha'ayel asher ra'isa balak kranayim, the ram with the two horns that you saw represents Malchei Modei Paras, the kings of Modei and Paras. So therefore you're going to say, well, that shows, in other words, that the Persians are compared to sheep, and therefore Tzeir Yatzayin refers to them. The problem is, says Rav Ba'ula, Ve'ema Yavon, maybe instead it could just as well refer to the Greeks. Dichtei Vatzofer Asor Melech Yavon. In that same vision, Daniel sees a goat, and then he's told that this represents the king of Greece, Alexander the Great, and then his various successors. So maybe what the pasuk is, so maybe then going back to Tzeir Yatzayin, when it's saying that the Edom will be defeated by Tzeir Yatzayin, Tzayin can also include goats. So maybe it means the Romans will be defeated by the Greeks. So the Gemara tells, Kisolak Rav Chaviva Bar Surmaki, when Rav Chaviva Bar Surmaki came up from Eretz Yisrael, from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, Amra Kamei Da'ahu Min Rabbanon, he tells over to one of the Chachamim in the Yeshiva, this question of Rav Ba'ola's, where is Rebbe getting that from the word Seiri Atzayin that Adavka means the Persians? And Amalei, and the Sahumir Abonon, one of these Chachamim, said to Rav Chaviva Bar Surmaki, the question doesn't even begin. Mandala Yoda Purishi Kroi, anybody who, a person like Rav Ba'ula, who apparently doesn't know how to understand the Pesukim, Moisif Tiyuv to the Rebbe, such a person is going to ask and try to shlog up Rebbe, he's not understanding the Pesuk properly. My Tse'ire Atzoin, what are we, don't focus so much on the word Tzoin, focus on the word Tse'ire, the youngest of. Therefore, it means Zutra Drachui, so it has to mean the one who is the youngest of his brothers. And Etani Rabbi Yosef Tiras Leparas. Earlier on the top of the Amud, we said that Tiras, which is Yefes' seventh and youngest son, is the ancestor of the Persians. Therefore, the Persians, more than any other nation, can be described as Tzeire Hatzon, the youngest of the sheep. And therefore, so not just because the Persians are compared to a sheep, to a ram, which is an adult sheep, but also because they were descended from Tiras, which is the youngest of the brothers. So therefore, that's it. That's what it means, in other words, according to Rebbe, that the Romans are eventually going to fall into the hands of the Persians and be defeated by them. On the other hand, Amar Rav Babachana, Amar Rabbi Yechon, Meshum Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Loi, the other way around. Asidu Roi Vishitipo Biad Paris. It's going to be the other way around. The Romans are going to fall into the hands, or not the other way around, but the same thing. That the same thing, the Romans are going to fall into the hands of the Persians, but for a different reason. Kal v'chomer. Not just based on the pasuk, not just based on the pasuk Tzeir Yatzoin, but because of a kal v'chomer. Umam Mikdash Rishon Shibna'u B'nei Shem. Madach, the first Beis Mikdash, where descendants of Shem built it. It was built under the sponsorship of Shlomo, who was descended from Shem. Ve'achrivu Kastiyim. And later on, the Kastiyim, the Bavliyim, who are descended from whoever they're descended from, they ended up destroying the first Beis Mikdash. And later on, Naflu Kastiyim B'yad Parsiyim. And eventually, the Kastiyim, in turn, were defeated by the Persians. After the 70 years of Golus Bavel. So we see, in other words, the Persians were able to defeat the nation that destroyed the first Beis Mikdash. Well, then Mikdash Sheni Shibna'ul Parsiyim, the second Beis Mikdash, the Persians have the schus that they actually built it, that it was built under their sponsorship, under the sponsorship of Kodesh. And eventually the Romans destroyed it. Shouldn't it be therefore Kavachomer that the Romans will fall into the hands of the Persians, that they will again defeat the nation, the Romans, that destroyed the second Beis Mikdash, just like they defeated the Kassim who built the first Beis Mikdash, especially because they have the Mila that they actually built the second Beis Mikdash. Okay. On the other hand, Omer Rav, Asida Poras Shetipo B'yad Roimi. On the other hand, Rav says not like Rebbe, and not like Rebbe Huda B'Rebbe Loi. The other way around, the Persians are going to fall into the hands of the Romans. Omer Le Rav Kahana V'Rav Asi Le Rav, so Rav Kahana and Rav Asi ask Rav, how is that possible? Benuye B'yad Sisari. Is it right that the ones who built the Beis Mikdash should fall into the hands and be defeated by the ones who destroyed the Beis Mikdash? The Persians have the source of building the second Beis Mikdash. The Romans destroyed it. Hayitach and the Romans are going to overpower the Persians. Omelahu Ein. So he tells them, yes, Zeras Melachi. That's how it is. Zera Min HaShemayim. That even though we don't always understand how these things work, nevertheless, that is how it's going to happen. Ikadamri, another version is that Rav Kahana, that Rav did give them a reason. Ikadamri, Amalei, actually it's supposed to be Amalahu, Inunami Hakasasri Beit Knishta. After all, the Persians themselves don't have completely clean hands. They also tear down shuls. In different places, and I guess in different places and times during the Persian Empire, they tore down shuls. So they don't have clean hands either. So therefore, yes, so the Eibishter is going to judge them strictly, and they're going to end up being defeated and then being taken over by the Romans. In fact, Ben Yehoyada points out, even when it came to building the second Beis Mikdash, even though Kodesh did sponsor it, nevertheless, the Gemara explains in Rosh Hashanah that eventually Kodesh went bad, and among other things, he had the blueprint drawn up in such a way, there'll be wood in it, there'll be exposed wood in such a place where if the Jews rebel against him, he's going to be able to easily burn the place down. So even though, yes, the Persians did build the second Beis Mikdash, but they built it to begin with ulterior motives that they could destroy it if they want to. So therefore, Rav is saying that they don't deserve to have the schus of defeating the Romans. Tani Nami Hachi. In fact, we learn similarly in a Braisa. Asida Poras Shetipo B'Yad Roimi. In the future, the Persians are going to fall into the hands of the Romans. Chodah Desasri Beit Knishta. Number one, because the Persians are guilty of destroying shuls. V'oi Gzeras Melech Hushib L'Bonin B'Yad Soistrim. And second of all, to Gzera Min HaShemayim. That in this case, the ones who built the Beis Mikdash are going to fall into the ones in the hands that destroy it. Now, historically, I mean, there were a number of times throughout the whole time of the Gemara, and then for a little bit afterward into the time of the Uli Goinim, the Persians and the Romans were pretty much constantly at war, and sometimes one defeated the other, and sometimes the other way around. There were times when each of them came pretty close to taking over the other one, so maybe our Gemara is talking about something that already happened historically, or maybe it's talking about something that has yet to happen. I mean, the Gemara in Avodah Zarah mentions that of all the various Malchias, only Edom and Paras, only these two that we're mentioning over here, the Romans and the Persians, are going to continue existing as powerful, as great powers until Mashiach comes. The Maharal has an explanation about it. The four Malchias represent the four directions and four different aspects of human society, and two of them are essential, so much so that they're still going to exist as independent known entities until Mashiach comes. In this connection, The Amr of Yehuda Amar Rav, we also see that Rav Yehuda says in the name of Rav, Ein ben David ba, ben David Mashiach won't come, Aj tifshet malchus roimi harashab halalim kula tisha hadashim, until the wicked Roman government ends up spreading out and ruling over the entire world for 9 months. So therefore, the point is, eventually the Persians have to defeat the Greeks, eventually the Romans have to defeat the Persians as well, in order for this to be Niskayim. Shenema, as the Pasuk says, Lachem, therefore Yitnem, Hashem will give them into the hands of their enemies, Ad Esye Leda Yalada, until the time when a woman gives birth, which is 9 months pregnancy, the Yeser Echav, Yishuvan, Abnei Israel, and then Mashiach will come, and all of his brothers will return to Bnei Israel, in other words, they'll be the Kibbutz Golias and the Golamit Esfash. So therefore, in other words, according to that, the idea is, given that the Romans eventually had, there kind of has to come a point when they rule over the entire world, including Persia, that's a prerequisite for Mashiach coming. Therefore, yes, it's Gzeiras Melech that the Persians are going to have to be defeated by the Romans. What do we mean that nowadays we still have the Romans and the Persians as independent entities? Rome itself is the capital of Italy, but it's not particularly strong. It's not particularly strong power. So first, we've mentioned before, for example, that America, that the United States, is founded a lot on Roman ideals. So it may be the successor to Rome as far as that. Or another possibility that a number of Sfarim talk about is Rome over here stands in for the Christians, which eventually that became their state religion, and Persia stands in for the Muslims. Persia, Iran, nowadays is one of the centers is one of the big centers of Islam in the world, and therefore it means that those two are still at loggerheads and sometimes fighting with each other and sometimes having temporary pieces, and eventually one of them is going to overpower the other.
What defines Rome is their laws, and the U.S. and Western Europe all agree that their laws are based on Roman law.
Yeah, exactly. English common law and American common law are based on Roman examples. The French civil law is also based on Napoleon's code, which eventually goes back to that. Right. But I'm saying, besides that, I'm saying not just the laws, but also culturally, for example. You have a large part of the U.S. Constitution was modeled on things from the Roman Republic. The United States uses mottos like E Pluribus Unum and other such things that come from Latin. The founding fathers saw themselves as heirs to the traditions of Rome, and therefore, in that sense, they can be considered the modern Rome. Yeah. Okay. Back to Halacha Gemara. Now that we're done with the Agata, Tanan Rabbanan. Now we got into this whole discussion at the last part. We got in by trying to show that the Persians descend from Yefes, which in turn was based on, we said that Rish Lakish had blamed the fact that there was no great level of Hashuras Hashchina in the second Mikdash on a different reason, because the Jews didn't all come to build it. So previously we had talked about the contrast between the first and second Bate Mikdash, where the first Bate Mikdash, among other things, the Kohenim Gdolim with Tzadikim, whereas in the second Bate Mikdash they weren't. And we said that originally what we had said is the Kohenim Gdolim and the second Bate Mikdash generally were replaced every year, and therefore the chamber that they stayed for the week before Yom Kippur is called Lishkas Parhedrin, where we said Parhedrin means a kind of government officials that are usually replaced every year. So now let's talk more about that Lishka. Now we're going to have a sugya that's going to extend over the next block and a half or so, talking about the Dinim of Mezuzah. None of the chambers in the Bais Mikdash had a mezuzah, because nobody lived in there for any length of time. Chutz Lishkas Parhedrin, with the exception of Lishkas Parhedrin, since the Kohen Gadol lived there, therefore it needed a mezuzah. Amr of Yehuda, but Rav Yehuda says, Valikam Lashachas Shoyi B'Mikdash Shoyi Lahen Bais Dira. What do you mean? Rav Yehuda says, You had lots of other chambers in the Bais Mikdash that are used, for example, by the watchmen. You have the Kohenim and Levim standing guard by the Bais Mikdash each night. And you had various rooms where they stayed in or slept in or whatever. V'loi ha'ilahan mezuzah. And those rooms didn't have a mezuzah. So why should the Lishkas Parhedrin require? Ela Lishkas Parhedrin gzeira ha'isa. Rather, Rav Yehuda says, it's not d'oraisa that the Lishkas Parhedrin required a mezuzah, it's only a gzeira d'rabbanan, for reasons that we're going to talk about on Amud Beis. The Rashi brings it over here. We don't want people to think that the Kohen Gadol is in jail. If you don't have a mezuzah on the door of the chamber where he's in, then people are going to think it's like a jail. There's a discussion among achronim whether a jail cell is chayiv in mezuzah. But the point is, if there's no mezuzah over there, people are going to think that they're putting the kohen gadol into a place like that, into a room that's not even chayiv in mezuzah. And it would be a gnai, and therefore, according to Rabbi Yehuda Midrabbanan, we put up a mezuzah. There was an interesting idea, actually, one of the Noisei Kelim on the Rambam, I forget which one, I think the Lechem Mishnah, learns what they do with this chamber the whole rest of the year when the Kohen Gadol wasn't staying in it, outside of the week before Yom Kippur, they would store wood in it. So you have a very good reason people are going to think that they're locking up in a storage house for a few days, and therefore they would have to have a mezuzah on it. Okay, so let's analyze the two opinions. My time is Rabbi Yehuda. Why does Rabbi Yehuda say that Daraisa the Lishkas Parhedrin does not require a mezuzah? Omar Rava, or Rava, it says on the side over here, because Kasavar of Yehuda, Rabbi Yehuda takes the view, Kol Bayis Shena Osir, the Mosek Chamel, the Mosek Shamim, any house or any room that's not made to use both during the summer and the winter, Ene Bayis is not considered a house and does not require a mezuzah. So now, the Kohen Gadol stays in this room for only a week, so therefore it's according to Rabbi Yehuda, it doesn't have the chashivus enough to be considered a room. Whereas the Chachamim disagree, and they say as long as it's inhabited, then it is chayiv in a mezuzah. Actually, Gvura Sari points out, when you think about it, usually a place should be chayiv in a mezuzah only if somebody lives in there for 30 days. Here he's only there for 7 days. So he gives an answer because the Torah requires him to be there, because we learned at the beginning of the parak the whole concept of prisha, that the Kohen Gadol has to be sequestered for a few days, so therefore that gives it a certain chashivos and makes it as if he had lived there for 30 days. Some of the other mafoshim explain that maybe the Kohen Gadol would occasionally stay there on different nights throughout the different days or nights throughout the year as well. He had to stay there for the 7 days before Yom Kippur, but during the rest of the year also there could be enough other times that he stays there. That it could be considered that altogether in the aggregate it adds up to at least 30 days.
You implied someone who owns a property and doesn't stay there doesn't need a mezuzah? Is that the halacha?
Well, first of all, the halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda, but we're talking according to Rabbi Yehuda. But according to Rabbi Yehuda, the pastor, you would say a place like that is roi. He could stay there anytime he wants. He just doesn't. According to Rabbi Yehuda, it might be, for example, that let's say a bungalow in a bungalow colony, conceivably, might be potter from a mezuzah, according to Rabbi Yehuda, because not meant to live in there during the winter. Although nowadays they're winterized ones, so maybe it is, I don't know. But like the old-style bungalows that are not winterized, maybe. I mean, the halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda anyway. The halacha is like a chachamim, that as long as it's a base dira and it's 4x4 amos and has a couple of other criteria, then it's chayiv in mezuzah. So the Gemara says, Esve Abaya. So Abaya asks a question on Rava or Rabba. How could you say that Rabbi Yehuda says that a house that's not meant to live in all seasons is not considered a house? Well, you have a pasuk in Amos where he's criticizing the Aseres HaShvatim for the lifestyle they live, that they led. They're rich, they're comfortable, they're decadent, they're involved in Tanuga Elamazer rather than thinking about Torah and mitzvahs. And he says, the Kesi Beis HaChorif al Beis HaKayetz, I will strike and destroy the winter houses together with the summer houses. In other words, the Goyim, Sancheir of his army, are going to conquer out Israel, and they're going to destroy these big, beautiful mansions that these people have. So it's called Beis HaChorif, the winter house, and Beis HaKayetz, the summer house. So you see that such places are called houses. Amalei, so Rava or Rava answers him, Beis Chodov or Beis HaKayetz, sure, it calls it with a secondary name, the winter house, the summer house. Bayis Stamalei Ikri, but it's not called plain Bayis without an adjective attached. Al Derech, like you have in other places in Halacha, we do similar kind of things. We say, for example, you need Ezoiv for certain purposes in Halacha. It has to be the kind that's called just Ezoiv, not the kind that's called some subspecies of Ezoiv. Ezoiv Yevoni, Ezoiv Kuchli, whatever. The same way over here, we're saying that Rabbi Yehuda would say that only a place that's called Bayis without any other adjective attached is the kind that's Chayiv in a mezuzah. But over here, it's not called that. It's only called Beis HaChorif and Beis HaKayetz. Okay, Abaya asked another contradiction on him. A Braisa says, actually it's a Mishnah really, Sukkos HaChag B'Chag. Now, we know like this, the background to the next piece, we know that produce becomes chayev in Truma and Mice, so only if it's brought in through Pnei HaBayis, brought in through the front of the house. Up until that point, you'd be allowed to eat a snack from it. After that, you're not allowed to, till you take Truma and Meiser. So the Mishnah says, Sukkah Sachag Bachag. What if a person brings in the produce into the Sukkah during Sukkahs? Does that count as that now it's Nikba for Meiser, and now we can't eat a snack from it? Rabbi Yehuda Mechayev Acham Poitrin. Rabbi Yehuda says he's Chayev to take Truma and Meiser from it, because Rabbi Yehuda considers it a house, even though, of course, it's only for the 7 days of Sukkot. But Chachamim Poitrin, the Chachamim say it would be Potter, because it's not considered a house. V'toni Allah, and we learn a Braisa about that. Rabbi Yehuda Mechayev the Eruv over Mezuzah over Meiser. Rabbi Yehuda says, in addition to that, not only is Sukkah considered, during Sukkahs, considered a house to the extent that produce brought into the, through the door of it is considered like it was brought through the door of the house, but also he says it would be Chayev in an Eruv. If you have a Sukkah in a Chotzer with other houses over there, they would need to join the Sukkah into an Eruv. Again, the Halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda in this. The Halacha is like the Chachamim, and in fact, there's a story when the Rebbe's father, Reb Levick, was going for his smicha, he was getting fahered by Reb Chaim Brisker, and some balabatim came to ask a question over there. It was Shabbos Sukkos. They'd forgotten to make an Erev Chatzeres. What can they do? And Reb Levick explained that actually, Al Pi Halacha, the Sukkah itself, during the week of Sukkos, during the Shabbos of Sukkos, counts itself as an Erev, because everybody in the Chatzer is eating jointly in that Sukkah. So obviously that would be only according to the Chachamim, but Pashtus Rabbi Yehuda would disagree. There's a Sicha someplace where the Rebbe analyzes that whole question and answer. I'll be Alocha, and I'll be Pnimi Yasein Yonim. Anyway, so Rabbi Yehuda is Mechayev the Sukkah in Eruv, and also in Mezuzah, and also in Meiser, again, that if produce is brought in through the front of the house, it's Chayev in Meiser. So you see that Rabbi Yehuda says that even though it's only for the week of Sukkot, nevertheless, it's still considered a house. So what are you telling me that he holds that only a place that's meant for living in all year round would be Chayev in Mezuzah? Now you might answer, okay, Rabbi Yehuda is saying that it's not. Rabbi Yehuda is not saying that these dinim apply midaraisa. Maybe he says only midrabanan. Do you need to put up a sukkah, and only midrabanan do you need an eruv and so forth? So b'shleima eruv and mezuzah ikalameim midrabanan. Sure, when it comes to eruv and mezuzah, you could say that maybe daraisa would be potter, and only midrabanan is a chayim in eruv. The whole concept is midrabanan anyhow. Ela meiser mi ikalameim midrabanan. But when it comes to meiser, how could you think that it is? That it is midrabanan, as the Gemara is going to continue, that Meiser has to be, so you have to have something chayiv in Meiser d'oraisa. Before we get to that, by the way, Tosfos and Tosfos Shishonim ask the question that not only we have a contradiction in what Rabbi Yehuda says, we seem to also have a contradiction in what the Chachamim are saying. Before, the Chachamim said that the Lishkas Pahedrin is chayiv in Mezuzah d'oraisa. Here they're saying that the Sukkah is potter. There are some of the Rishonim who say very simple, the Rabbanan who argue with Rabbi Yehuda about the Lishkas Pahedrin are not necessarily the same Rabbanan who argue with him in the Mishnah and Maestris about whether a Sukkah is considered a house or not. Tosfos Rishonim give a couple of other reasons over here. A Sukkah, after all, is Diras Arai. It could very well happen that it's raining or otherwise uncomfortable and you're leaving, whereas the Lishkas Pahedrin, the Kohen is staying there with Kvius for the 7 days. So they have more reason to say that the Lishkas Pahedrin is Chayev in a Mezuzah than a Sukkah. And therefore, they might say that the Sukkah is maybe completely Potter. Tosfos Rishonim says another thing also the Gemara doesn't bother with that question, but how we reconcile the Chachamim. Either like some other Rishonim say that there are two different sets of Chachamim, or like Tosfos, like main Tosfos says that a Sukkah is Diras Arai. Anyway, going back to the Gemara, when it comes to Meiser, how can you say that Rabbi Yehuda is saying that Midaraisa, a house would not be Mechayev, that Midaraisa, a Sukkah, would not be Mechayev produce in Meiser, and only Dirabanan it does? Can't be. The problem with that is, if you have produce that's only Chayev Dirabanan, Dilma Osi La'afrush, Minachiyuv Ala Potter, or Minapotter Ala Chiyuv, then you might get mixed up. You're going to think that this is actually Chayev in Meiser Daraisa, and you're going to end up taking Meiser, Truma and Meiser from this produce on behalf of other produce, which is Chayev Daraisa, or vice versa, and that's no good. So therefore, necessarily, when we say that it's Chayev in Meiser, it has to be Daraisa. So you can't say that Rabbi Yehuda is just saying Dirabanan. Now, Tosfos asks, what do you mean? We have many things that are chayev. Tosfos and Tosfos Rishonim ask, there are many places where we know that something is chayiv and ma'aseh on the derabanan. The whole concept of d'maish, for example, is a takana derabanan, because d'oraisa we say most damei oretz are ma'aser, and therefore there's no problem. So Tosfos says, Tosfos goes through them. For example, in that case with d'mai, the very fact that you don't have to take truma itself is a heker that it's only derabanan. Because we say that all the Amei Oretz did give truma, therefore you don't have to take it out when you buy Dmai, but that itself also serves as a heker to remind that it's Derabanan. And then you have also, Tosfos goes through a couple of other possibilities. What about when you buy grain from a goy? What about grain that came from Chutz La'aretz, where there used to be a minig to take truma and ma'aser from it, and so forth. So there are various cases where we see that something is chayiv and ma'aser d'rabbanan, but in each of those cases, Tosfos explains why there's less of a problem, that people are going to get mixed up and think that it's chayiv d'oraisa. There is also the point. Tosfos Yeshanim talks about what happens. Big deal. Let's say, for example, that what if he did take meiser from this produce on behalf of other produce? Okay, it's not yet chayiv and meiser d'oraisa. Still, it's still not potter from meiser either. You can just eat a snack from it, but ultimately meiser does have to be taken from it. But Tosfos is trying to explain that, let's say, for example, he brought it into the sukkah through the roof of the sukkah, or through a backyard or something. So then what happens is, if you have other grain, for example, that you brought into the house in a different way of derech arai, you still have the straw mixed in with it, for example, then you're going to get mixed up and think that you can take from one on behalf of the other when it's not so. Some of the Mefoshim actually learn that once it was brought into the sukkah, then even bringing it into the house later is not going to make it chayiv d'oraisa, if we say that the sukkah is potter. Anyway, however we explain this Gemara, the point is that we can't say that Rabbi Yehuda is saying that the sukkah makes the produce chayiv and ma'aser only d'rabbanan, because that would create other problems. Necessarily, it must be that Rabbi Yehuda is saying it's chayiv and ma'aser d'oraisa. Therefore, b'pashtus, he's saying the same thing as far as mezuzah and eruv's d'rabbanan. But as far as mezuzah, so there you see that he's saying that even a sukkah, which is only used for 7 days, is chayiv in a mezuzah. So what are you telling me, that he's pater in the lishkas parhedrin because the kohen gadol only stays there for a week? Then Rabbi Yehuda is contradicting himself. Ela, Amar Abaye said, no, Abaye gives a different answer. B'shiva, b'kula amalei pligi d'machayiv. During the 7 days of Prisha, there's no machloikas, everybody would agree that the lishkas parhedrin is chayiv in a mezuzah. Ki pligi b'shav yimayis hashanah. The argument between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim is, what about do you have to keep a mezuzah over there on the doors, the lishkas parhedrin, the rest of the year? Namely, Rabbanan Savri Gazrin and Shavi Mois Hashana Otto Shiva. Rabbi Yehuda holds, we have to make, not Rabbi Yehuda, the Chachamim rather hold, the Rabbanan hold, we have to make a gzera that there should be a mezuzah on there for the rest of the year. In other words, so they're both agreeing that it's chayiv only, that during the 7 days it's chayiv d'oraisa, and during the rest of the year it's not chayiv at all. But the Rabbanan hold, it's not chayiv d'oraisa. The Rabbanan will hold, it still is chayiv d'oraisa during the rest of the year. Not d'oraisa, the Rabbanan during the rest of the year, because gazrin and shayim mois hashana otu shiva. We have to make a gzera, because if you don't put up a mezuzah the rest of the year, you might forget to put one on during the 7 days that the Kohen Gadol is there, and the 7 days that he's there, it's definitely chayiv. So therefore, the Chachamim will say the rest of the year, so during the 7 days it's d'oraisa, and during the rest of the year it's d'rabbanan. And then Rabbi Yehuda Saba, like as written, whereas Rabbi Yehuda says, there's no need to make that gzera. We put up a mezuzah for 7 days there, then we take it down when he leaves the Lishka before Yom Kippur, and that's that. So Tosfos teaches out, in other words, that because Rabbi Yehuda is saying, he said in the Brayse of Alek Kamal Shocha, so there are many chambers that are sometimes used for people to live in and to sleep in the Beis Mikdash, and nevertheless we don't say, so maybe when those rooms are being used they need a mezuzah, but as soon as you're done using them you can take down the mezuzah, so why should it be different by the Lishkas Parhedrin? And he's saying that the only reason to have it in the first place there is a gzera, as the Gemara is going to say soon, because we don't want people to think that the Kohen Gadol was in jail. There is a Tosfos gets into a long discussion of a different possible Girsa and a different possible explanation that we may have here in the Gemara. We're saying over here, the Girsa we have in front of us is that the Chachamim say we make a Gzera, that the mezuzah has to be on there the rest of the year, because we may forget to put it on during the 7 days, and Rabbi Yehuda holds not like that. Tosfos has a long discussion over here about what the Gemara means in that case, and Tosfos ends up saying that there's actually a different Girsa the other way around. The Chachamim said Loi Gazrinan, and Rabbi Yehuda says Gazrinan. And therefore, so Tosfos explains that actually it's referring not to the Lishkas Sanhedrin, but rather to the Sukkah. Do we need to put up a mezuzah on a Sukkah or not? So Rabbi Yehuda, the Chachamim say that you don't need to, and we don't make a Zeder that you should need to, and then Rabbi Yehuda is saying you do, because we don't want people to think that being in the Sukkah is like being in jail. And then Tosfos goes through how they would explain the whole Sugya according to that logic. Okay. Amalei Rava, so Rava says, what do you mean? So you're saying that the whole machlokes between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim is only about the 7 days of Prisha for Lishkas Sanhedrin, or only about the 7 days of Sukkos, or no, that there's no machlokes, rather, about the 7 days of Prisha and the 7 days of Sukkos, that for sure the Lishkas Sanhedrin or the Sukkah needs a mezuzah, according to everybody. And the machlokas is only the rest of the year. What do you mean? The Mishnah that we quoted before said that they're arguing about sukkah sachag b'chag, the sukkah for sukkahs during the Yom Tov of sukkahs itself. Rabbi Yehuda says it's b'chayev the food in Meiser, and then the Brai said that's chayev in a mezuzah, and the Chacham says it's potter. So even during sukkahs itself, the Chacham holds it's potter. Ella Omar Rava, so Rava says no, the other way around. The rest of the year, there's no question that the Lishkas Sanhedrin or the Sukkah are potter from mezuzah. Ki pligi b'shiva. They're arguing only within the 7 days of Sukkos or the 7 days of Prisha. And the Sukkah time alachod, the Lishka time alachod. And each one, the Sukkah and the Lishka, has its own reason for Rabbi Yehuda to be saying that it's chayev and mezuzah. All this time we've been assuming that the logic is the same way. If one of them is chayev, the other one necessarily is chayev. Now we're saying that actually no, there are in fact different reasons why Rabbi Yehuda would say that a sukkah is chayev during the 7 days, and why he would say that on the other hand the Lishka Sanhedrin is potter midaraisa and chayev only dirabbanan. So, Rabbi Yehuda l'taimei, when it comes to Sukkah, Rabbi Yehuda is following his own Svara, Yom HaSukkah Diras Kvah. He says in several places in Masech the Sukkah that the Sukkah has to be a Diras Kvah, a permanent kind of dwelling place. For that reason, the Gemara mentions that's why he holds a Sukkah can be taller than 20 Amos. That's why he holds that a sukkah has to be at least 4x4 amos, and so forth, various things. He holds, for example, that a sukkah, that if you have a bed inside a sukkah with a canopy over it, then you can still sleep under it because the sukkah is a diras keva, and the canopy is only a diras arai, so it's not mevatel the sukkah, etc. So you have a number of dinim that Rabbi Yehuda says depend on the fact that sukkah is diras keva. So therefore, he considers it a house regarding the dinim of mezuzah and holds that it would be chayav daraisa during the 7 days. But Rabbanan the time of Damas Sukkah diras arai b'inim, whereas the Chacham hold according to their shita that the sukkah is only a diras arai, it's only a temporary dwelling for the 7 days. For that reason, they say it has to be lower than 20 amos and a number of other dinim that come out of that. So v'loy mechayav mezuzah. So if it's only a diras arai, it's not required to have a mezuzah. Now, so that's as far as sukkah. The Lishka, now on the other hand, when it comes to the Lishka, time of the Chod, it has a separate reason. Obviously there it's not a matter of Diras Arei or Diras Keva. Namely, Rabbanan Sabri Dira Bal Kocha Shma Dira, the Rabbanan hold that even if you're forced to live in a place, it's still considered a Dira. And therefore, so fine, the Kohen Gadol is forced to live in this place for a week, but nevertheless, it's still considered a Dira. Therefore, it requires a mezuzah. Whereas Rabbi Yehuda holds, if you're forced to live in a place, then it's not considered a dira. So really, on daraisa, then the lishka should be potter from mezuzah. The Chachamim made a takana that you should put up mezuzah during the 7 days. So people don't think that the Kohen Gadol is being thrown into jail. Like this, if you don't have a mezuzah on the door, then people are going to think it's like a room that doesn't even deserve to be called a room. So that's the last explanation. So again, we had several explanations why Rabbi Yehuda would say that the Lishka Sparhedrin is Potter. We thought that it's because he says that only if it's used all year round, but we said no. We said that maybe he's only talking about is it Chayev during the rest of the year or not, where according to the Gius that we have in front of us in the Gemara, Rabbi Yehuda would say that it's only Chayev during the 7 days. And now we're saying the other way around, that Rabbi Yehuda is saying even that Dirabbanan, Daraisa, it's not Chayev at all, only Dirabbanan is it Chayev. And so we do that only during the 7 days, only so that people don't think the Kohen Gadol is in jail. Okay. Next, Man Tana Lahoda Tana Rabbanan. Which Tana is it that says what we learn in the following Braisa? So between these two Tanoim, Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, we learn in a Braisa, Kol HaShe'orim Shehoyu Shom Lahoy Lahem Mezuzah, all the gates of the Bismikdash, in all the gates of the Azara, did not have Mezuzahs, Chutz M'Shar Nikaner, with the exception of Shar Nikaner, Shalefnim Mimenu Lishkas Behedrin, because you would go through Shar Nikaner to reach the Lishkas Behedrin, and therefore, since the Lishkas Behedrin requires a Mezuzah, so does Shar Nikaner. HaGoyis HaGura, by the way, changes it over here to Shar Amayim, the water gate, which we learned in Shkolim, is one of the gates on the south side of the Azara. The Gemara later on in our Perek is going to discuss which side of the Azara was the Lishkas Parhedrin, on the north or the south. So if we say it was on the south, then you'd go through Shar Amayim to get to it. Anyway, so Lamer Rabbanan Hivalei Rabbi Yehuda. It would seem that that Braisa that says that Shar Nikaner requires a mezuzah would be only according to the Chachamim, not according to Rabbi Yehuda. The E Rabbi Yehuda, because if you were going to say it goes according to Rabbi Yehuda, he, Gufuk Zera, after all, he's learning, the way we just said, that the fact that the Lishkas Parhedrin itself even needs a mezuzah is only a Zera de Rabbanan, so people don't think the Kohen Gadol is in jail. V'anan Nekum V'nigzav Zera L'Zera. How could we then go and make a Zera on top of a Zera, say that Shar Nikaner should require a mezuzah because, as a gzera, because you have Lishkas Parhedrin further in, and Lishkas Parhedrin itself is only chayv and mezuzah because of a takana de Rabbanan. So therefore, it would seem it's only according to the Chachamim. The Gemara says, no, I feel the tamer of Yehuda. You could even say that Braisa goes according to the Yehuda. Kula chod gzera, because the whole thing is one big gzera. The Gemara often says that it's not a gzera or gzera. It's one big gzera. This part of that we're saying that the Lishkas Parhedrin has to have a mezuzah so that people don't think it's a jail. Part of that is that the gates that lead to it, such as Shar Nikaner, also have to have a mezuzah. Just like you have. If your house requires a mezuzah, then the gate to your front garden or whatever also requires a mezuzah. Which we're going to talk about. We're going to continue in the Gemara tomorrow, talking about these dinim, what kinds of gates do and don't require mezuzahs, and what kinds of rooms do and don't require mezuzahs. We're going to continue with the sugya on the halachas and mezuzah all the way until close to the bottom of Yud Aleph Amud Beis, or actually even until the top of Yud Beis Amud Aleph.
Yashikayach.
After.
Yeah, I'm